Would you introduce yourselves, please?
Yeah, I'm Michael Rosen. Jonathan Rosen, Michael's younger brother.
Okay. And in fake binaural stereo, what is the name of the band?
Cones.
You want to do that any other way? You want to sing it? You want to rap it? Do you want to... You don't have to.
I feel like it would be the same any way we tried it. Rapping it.
You
would
go low, I'll go high.
Okay.
Cones. I think you were better off the first time around. So we got your brothers. We got your 2.5 years-ish as a band. We've got your Aaron Espinoza. We've got your Danger Bird. We've got your CD released this past month. We're done. There's nothing left. Now, this is fairly early on for you, but I did find stuff. There's stuff out there. What so far are you amazed you haven't been asked?
I feel like we've been asked a lot about, you know, being brothers.
Sometimes I wish people would ask me more about, like, what the lyrics mean. But really, I think if I were asked that, I would actually not want to be asked that. So,
I have a question for you. Actually, too. Are you brothers?
We're brothers.
Good. What do the lyrics... No, I'm kidding.
On a personal level, I'd like to be asked more. I do a lot of the production and engineering. I'd like to be asked more about that sort of thing. In a production sense, what we're doing and how we approach that.
SFO to LA, SFO being San Francisco, for those of you in other places that don't know. LA for Los Angeles, you know, because acronyms are complicated.
LAX.
Right, LAX, exactly. If we're booking a flight. But how long were you in SFO? What brought you here? And then there's NYC in the mix too. So unravel this, because basically when you go to that internet thingy, you get this stew that doesn't identify anything yet. So we're here to be detectives and figure this out.
All right, 1986, August 7th, Michael Rosen's born in San Francisco. 2.5 years later, I'm born in San Francisco. Then we were raised there for many years, and we went to college. I went to college in New York. He went to college in Ohio. I went to Bard College. Michael went to Oberlin College.
Oberlin College, Conservatory of Music. I graduated from Oberlin. I studied music composition and music technology there, and I'm a pianist. Just studied music, and then I moved to New York, and Jonathan had a couple years left at Bard, and he moved to New York after he graduated, and we were there playing music, and Jonathan was working as an animator. I was working actually as a creative technologist, programmer for weird interactive projects, and we're playing music out there, and we started touring. We joined Eleanor Friedberger's band. She was the singer of the Fiery Furnaces, and we played with her, toured with her, and recorded music with her for a few years. That brought us out to LA, where we decided to move and sort of almost go full circle, not to San Francisco, but back to California. And it was on tour with Eleanor that we decided to create Cones. We wanted to just do our own thing.
Have you played the Great American Music Hall yet?
That is the dream. That's a great question. Like, I grew up going there. I saw all my favorite shows there and fell in love with music there. The answer is, so, okay. The first one that comes to mind is right after Funeral by Arcade Fire came out. They were touring the release of that album, and we saw them there. I was like 14, and it completely changed my life. Like, just 10 to 12 people on stage with, like, they had like motorcycle helmets on. They were drumming on each other's heads. Like, I had never... I didn't know that music could do that, and it completely, I've wanted to play there. Someday I hope to. Yeah.
Yeah. And that I was also at that show. And it was just at that age, seeing something with that kind of energy, the energy that they had at that moment, it was so unbelievable.
This label that we're sitting in right now, Danger Bird, getting signed, Aaron Espinoza. Now, I was at the CD release show, and he told me he discovered you. Now, I don't trust Aaron, so that he signed you. I mean, I hope he's listening. How many people courted you? How'd you go through the whole process? How'd you decide? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Just everyone was just like, man, we just got to get these. No. We're lucky to the first couple songs we released were through like an Atlantic Record subsidiary called Canvasback.
Sure.
That we just did sort of like a 2-song deal with them, and that it was like an amazing way to start, you know, a band to have to really get some stuff out there. And we had first just recorded a like a 5 or 6 song, what we thought was going to be an EP, but we decided to just release 2 of those songs with Atlantic, and they got some good attention. It was like sort of the right moment. And through that, Aaron, we had sort of made the rounds through LA a bit, and Aaron found us, emailed us about wanting to do another 2-song release. So we just sort of broke apart this EP that we had thought might have been released as a collection, but it just sort of dissected it a little bit. So we did a release with Danger Bird for 2 songs as well, and we just grew to really like, we really just knew Aaron at that point, but Aaron was just saying like really on point. He was just very honest and very on point, and like creatively a great match for us. Do you want to continue this, Jonathan, or should I keep going? Okay. And in terms of courting, we were talking to a number of labels for a while, and that process is pretty insane. And what it came down to is we actually recorded, after recording these sort of first 5 or 6 songs that I think identified our sort of sonic landscape, we tried out some other recording scenarios in a friend's studio. I should mention we just recorded the first 5 songs in a my little practice space with a few pieces of gear, and there was a lot of charm to it, I think. And when we tried to bring that out of our sort of safety net and into other studios, it didn't translate as much. So we made a record that I think is good, but just wasn't quite right for us as a, you know, as Cones. And Aaron helped us realize that it was a difficult thing to be like, you know, I think you guys could do better or something, right? Something that's more you. And with that honesty, that really just impressed us fully. And that's when we decided we should sign with Danger Bird, because we felt that they had our best interest at heart.
And once we decided to kind of scrap that and reapproach, we just like were immediately, it was right in the beginning of summer, last summer. And we just got immediately so inspired. Like I was pretty bummed at first to like kind of come to that realization of like put all this work and kind of poured a lot of myself into this record and just accepting that it wasn't really what I had hoped it was going to be, was a bummer. But you know, I was like, I was kind of depressed for like 2 weeks, and I was like, I just need to get out of town. So I drove up to Ojai and like brought my guitar and just kind of slept in my car and wrote the first song on Pictures of Pictures on that little trip. And then from that point on, we were just like, well, the first song, it's track 2, but it's like the first song written for that album. And so that was kind of like, I don't know, it all just sort of began in that moment.
So Honeymoon Suite is this, when we talk home studio in LA, that's usually like a back house.
I had a plan to make a recording studio for a while with 2 partners of mine, Dent May, who's a musician out here, and my friend Pat Jones, who is an amazing engineer. He does like Toro y Moi's records and front of house for them, and Washed Out, those kinds of bands. And he's a really great engineer. And we were looking for the right place for a while, and we found it's actually not like a garage. It's more of it's like a 1,000-square-foot commercial back house, sort of. So it's in Lincoln Heights. It's essentially in the parking lot of some storefronts. And it's its own own building that's not next to anything. So we constructed everything in there. We built out control rooms, did all the acoustics, everything. I mean, we, you know, a lot of construction labor, and built out a nice live room. We found some really good deals on some gear. We got a nice console in there called a Neotech. We have
Insane Clown Clown Posse recorded on it.
I say, yeah, on this Neo-Tech. It's made the round. Well, Aretha Franklin, ICP, Kid Rock. Yeah.
History.
Yeah. But yeah, we actually drove to Vegas to pick it up. It was out there for a really good deal. And Pat, my partner, is very savvy with electrical engineering, so he's fixed it up a lot. So how I see it is a commercial space that we rent out. So sort of in between, there are a lot of really built up like $1 million studios in LA. This is sort of somewhere in between your home studio and your commercial studio, where we have built out rooms, dedicated rooms, a lot of outboard gear, bunch of instruments, synths, etc. So we recorded at the time that we started this album was when the studio finally was ready to record. So I engineered it there. We produced it together, and we actually mixed it with, I don't like to mix my own. It's too close. So we mixed it with my partner, Pat, who's very good.
What is the filter for a Cone song? How do you know that song is going to be right for this band?
It's a really good question. Do you want to start it?
That's a great question. For me, as the like kind of main songwriter, I guess, and lyric writer, it's lyrically, I think it's like having a lightheartedness, but also a deeper meaning, and like sort of expressing like something vulnerable.
So dodgy.
Right. I think like something that I was doing on that record that we scrapped was like, I just felt like it was a bit heavy, some of the things I was trying to convey. And I think maybe that's just the way I was feeling at the time. But I find like my sensibility as a songwriter is like kind of trying to disarm you with lightness, and then kind of through that, letting some of the deeper stuff kind of hit you. And that's, I think that idea can be applied to our sonics as well. Like, there's a heaviness, there's like something serious, there's like a deep groove that we go for, you know what I mean? But there are kind of light, bubbly, almost childlike kind of cartoony sounds throughout the record that, I don't know, I hear in my head and I try to get Michael to find, or you know, things like that.
Yeah, so. I'll go on. I said the word "sound dodgy," and I don't know if you're familiar with that word. I'm a huge fan of Brazilian music, and it's a term that there's not necessarily a translation in English, but it's sort of like a form of nostalgia. It's like a feeling of experiencing, like missing something that you haven't experienced yet, or something like that. And I always think about that in terms of our music. And Jonathan was talking about, like, I think the filter is what does it, a big part of our music is the animation. Jonathan is an animator, and a lot of our music videos and our art content. Next. Yeah. Yeah. We need to feel that the music and the visuals represent each other. And I think that as long as we're listening to the sound of what we're making and it sort of matches up to our visual aesthetic, then we know we're on the right page.
You've made some real definitive decisions in, you know, filtering guitars, you know, synth sounds, which definitely back to Ocasek, or, you know, all of that, you know, and vocals kind of drowned in reverb. Drowned in reverb, which is all my thing. But that always leads people towards the nostalgia kick. When somebody says, you know, why did you make these sonic decisions? You know, certain synthesizer sounds in certain keys, certain guitar sounds, you know, and filters and thing and pedals and things that you put it through. And most definitely those vocals and the way you've tracked them and all of that. What do you tell them? What was the intent there? And how do you explain to them that it's not about nostalgia? It's about, you know, a sound that you're creating that's yours.
It's interesting. Well, with the vocals, we just sort of track them pretty regularly. I'm not processing anything live.
It's all in post.
That the vocals, but a lot of the rest of it.
Sometimes we ran it through like a
sometimes, yeah, I mean, sometimes I'll put it through like a Space Echo, yeah. or but I like to let yeah, the Eventide H3000 or something, I'll put it through that. But I'll often with the vocals, it's in post because I want to be able to match it to everything else. I mean, it's the most important thing. It's like the thing that sticks out the most. You want to make sure. I mean, a lot of people do most of the work in post, but I don't. I like to. I have some pieces of gear that I feel are very. It's about the process of recording. I think I have some pieces of gear that I like to employ during the recording process because it takes on its own soul. You're crafting the actual sound, not just like creating a sound, then thinking about it later. So we have a really cool piece of gear. It's a Lexicon 200, which is like a reverb from 1984. That's in between the famous 224 and 380 Lexicon reverbs. A lot of numbers there. But it was used for touring, actually, for its same algorithms as all those, but it was used for live sound touring, and we got one for a very sort of broken for a very good price, and we fixed it up. And we have a few pieces of gear like that, like Lexicon Primetime, H3000, Space Echo, a bunch of fun stuff. And for me, it's all about crafting the sound as we go.
So I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich. And what it is two of your songs on the outside and then songs by others in between.